if you were watching Prime Minister's Questions today, there was more pressure on Nadeem Zahawi, the former Chancellor and current Chairman of the Conservative Party, over his tax affairs. Last Friday, The Guardian broke the story that Mr. Zahawi had paid a penalty imposed by HMRC as part of an estimated £5 million tax bill, something the Prime Minister has said today that he didn't know at the time he made Nadeem Zahawi Tory chairman. This story has come out into the open thanks to the work of journalists and tax investigators. Two of them are with us today. Anna Isaac, The Guardian City editor, broke that story last week about the penalty Mr. Zahawi is believed to have paid. And Dan Needle is a former city tax lawyer who now has his own consultancy, Tax Policy Associates. Welcome to both of you. And Dan, you're not a journalist, but you've been blogging and publishing stories about Nadeem Zahawi since last summer. Just take us back to why you started following the story.
So I retired to set up a micro think tank, Tax Policy Associates, and people were asking me to look at this politician, that politician. They thought they'd avoided tax. And I did. And mostly it was rubbish. So something about Sunak on Channel 4 saying he'd avoided tax. Rubbish. Rees-Mogg, rubbish. And I said that. And then, just really to be mischievous, Jim Pickard at the FT and I launched a Freedom of Information Act request to see if any ministers had been the subject of HMRC inquiries. And to my surprise, shock even, they came back and said, yes, between one and five had. And Jim and I said, really, are you sure? And they said, yes, we're sure. And then there was something of a panic inside Whitehall, I believe, at this. And then we got a correction from HMRC saying, oh, no, sorry, that was a mistake, our bad. Actually, there are no ministers under inquiry, which made, I mean, you hardly have to be Bernstein and Woodward for your antennae to twing at that. Then there was that amazing story in The Independent claiming that Mr. Zahawi had been under investigation at one point by the NCA, SFO and HMRC. Apparently they found nothing. Zahawi denied it, but I'm familiar with those investigations. Normally the subject doesn't know they're being investigated. So what I then did is kind of what my day job was when I was a tax lawyer. People think tax lawyers are there dreaming up tax avoidance schemes. No, not in the last 20 years, really. They're not. What they normally do is much less glamorous. You've got a client who's thinking of taking over a company. What are the tax skeletons in that company's closet? Because if you buy it and it finds out they did bad tax stuff, that's going to cost you, the buyer, money. So entirely selfish capitalism incentives drive companies acquiring other companies and the tax lawyers working for them to try and uncover tax problems. So for me to do that on Zahawi's companies was not really any different from what I've been doing for many years as a tax lawyer.
Okay, and this was last summer, and you mentioned The Independent, and I should bring in Anna Isaac here, who's at The Guardian now, but just talk to me about when you got involved in the story, because obviously you were at The Independent at that point.
Yeah, that's right. In early July last year, I worked with Simon Walters, who's been a long-standing lobby reporter who was working freelance for The Independent at that stage, on the story about an HMRC investigation into Zahawi, and that was July 9 last year, and that started to feed into a sort of a buzz around his financial affairs. I should add that lots of people have asked and done various reports over the years, going back even a decade, to sort of ask a few questions about where Mr. Zahawi's wealth comes from. He's been a very successful person by all accounts, has a lot of money. So people have naturally taken some public interest examinations of that money. But that was when Simon and I wrote about the HMRC investigation for the first time.
OK, so that was the first we heard about it. That piqued your interest, Dan Needle, and you started looking at it. I mean, how much pickup at that time was there in the wider press about the story, Dan?
So my initial findings, let's call it a tax anomaly, it looked to me like a naive attempt at tax avoidance. Someone, a very experienced former HMRC inspector, said it looked like man in the pub tax avoidance, where someone does something thinking, oh, here's a clever way to avoid tax, but it doesn't work. And that's what I thought.
And of course, tax avoidance isn't illegal.
Tax avoidance is not necessarily illegal. No, that's correct. It looked to me like someone had done something thinking tax would be avoided, but actually I was really confident it wouldn't have been avoided. So when the valuable YouGov shares ended up being sold, yielding perhaps as much as 27 million quid, maybe more, I wondered if Mr. Zahawi paid tax on that or if he assumed his old scheme worked and didn't. So my the outcome of what I wrote was really a question. Did Mr. Zahawi pay tax on this? And this was covered again by Jim Pickard in the FT.
Okay, so it's interesting that we're now, you know, fast forward to January. That's a long time after last summer. And it's taken this long for, you know, The Sun earlier this month to break the story.
But there was a bit in the middle.
Oh, well, I'm sure we'll get to that in a minute. But what I want to say is it's a long time because The Sun broke this story that he'd paid millions in tax. Then you followed it up, Anna, with your story about how some of that potentially £1 million was a penalty. But it's been rumbling on since July. Anna, first of all, I'll ask you why you think it took so long to break through. I mean, presumably these are just very hard stories. Tax stories are very hard to get over the line. I mean, it's not like you've got endless information and access to people's individual tax status.
Yeah, absolutely. It takes an awfully long time to get to the point where you can be confident enough to publish something in some cases where you might have very little by way of additional information provided by the other party. You also have to make sure that you've got really sound public interest grounds for getting involved with private information, for instance. So you have to really do an assessment of, like, am I sure this isn't a fishing expedition? Am I sure there's a justification for examining someone's private arrangements? And you have to go through all of those stages to make sure that you're being really sound in the way that you approach an investigation. There are also legal considerations. And while I'm not talking about this story specifically, for reporters in general, we are finding there is an increasing use of lawyers and the legal system to try and suppress public interest journalism. And that has to be sort of a huge consideration when we think about how long some of these stories take to come out. We really have to weigh up a lot when it comes to putting a story like this together. It's a tricky process. It's very intricate.
And I know Dan Needle, we'll talk a bit about the experience you had with lawyers in this. I should make clear, of course, that the HMRC has made very clear they consider, in terms of Nadine Zahawi's tax affairs, that it was a careless and not a deliberate error, which is what he's consistently maintained. But I wonder, that same question to you, Dan, you know, from July to now, it's a difficult story to get over the line. What was going on in the meantime?
So I wrote that story, and my question was, Mr. Zahawi, did you pay tax on this? His response was to brief on background that the arrangements with this Gibraltar company, which had received the shares in YouGov that I think would have been his, they were justified because his father, through this company, provided the startup capital. And I looked at that in a lot of detail with forensic accountants helping me and decided that what he said was not correct. And I said so. And then he moved to another new explanation that his not mentioning startup capital, saying that his father had provided know-how and assistance in starting YouGov, and that was really valuable. Now, two journalists at the Times, Billy Kember and George Greenwood, chased that down and couldn't find support for people who worked at YouGov. They got an official denial out of YouGov, and then that all made me say publicly that I didn't believe the first explanation we'd been given, the startup capital one, for Mr. Zahawi. And it was that which prompted him to get lawyers to write to me, ordering me to retract that claim.
And were you, I was just wondering how you were you keeping the story alive on social media? What were you goading? I mean, what were you doing when it came to a back and forward with lawyers?
So initially I was out playing with the kids and I got a Twitter message from someone I didn't know, a partner at a law firm who I'd heard were acting for Zahawi. And he said, can we speak? And I'm an experienced lawyer. I know how these things work. I said, anything you want to say to me, you please put in writing, and I won't accept without prejudice correspondence, meaning private, confidential correspondence I can't repeat. Then later that day, I got an email from them, which was headed without prejudice, the very thing I'd asked them not to do, which ordered me to retract and said that I couldn't publish or even refer to this communication. If I did, there would be serious consequences. But I didn't mention this on social media at all. Partly, you know, Sun Tzu, don't interrupt your enemy when they're making a mistake. Partly, I thought the email was so confused. I didn't really understand what their position was, and I wanted to draw them out a bit more.
I mean, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second just to say, I mean, Anna, most journalists presumably don't necessarily have the confidence to deal with legal letters. You know, they are quite scary. I suppose, you know, if you're working in a company, there'll be a lawyer to advise you. But even so, you know, there are fears around it. But maybe it helped that Dan was a was a lawyer himself, he could read them in a way.
No question, Dan's made a really valuable contribution to illustrate some of the kinds of letters that members of the media might receive. I would pay huge tribute to the media lawyers I had both at The Guardian and The Independent, who have to sort of weigh things sometimes a bit differently, but have counselled it and have sort of allowed each stage of this reporting process to go ahead. You know, the stories have been published. But I do think what Dan's illustrating, and there's a broader point here, not talking about this story in particular, there's a broader point here about how the legal system in general might be used against public interest journalism. There are a lot of cases at the moment. For instance, there's one involving the permission given by the Treasury for the legal actions of someone linked to the Wagner Group against a journalist, Elliot Higgins. So what we're talking about is a broader context for journalism in the UK, and I think it's really important that we consider this as part of a bigger picture, and that Dan's contribution is part of this bigger picture that's very important.
Because these letters are off-putting. They
have to be treated very seriously.
People off.
Yeah, and is that line between using them as a signal, am I being fair? Am I being proportionate? Am I doing my job properly? And that line between trying to suppress journalism, that's what our media lawyers have to try and weigh for us and help us consider.
And obviously I should make clear that Mr. Zahawi's lawyers have said that they, you know, sent just a polite, confidential letter through the solicitors to Mr. Needle to correct a few inaccuracies. You know, this is fairly common practice legally, Dan Needle, but you chose to make the responses public. Why was that?
It is indeed common practice for libel lawyers to send letters which ask people to retract and then claim that they're confidential letters and can't be published. It's common practice and it's a disgrace, and the Solicitors Regulation Authority, I asked them, has now confirmed that solicitors may not do that.
It's interesting, isn't it? I just wonder whether you see yourself now as a journalist, and if you do, you know, where you think you stand in terms of being impartial. You know, lots of people could read your blog and think, you know, you get the sense that you set Nadeem Zahawi in your sights, and you know you were going to get him. That was what you were up to.
I really wasn't. And if he'd responded saying, for example, yes, I think there are. I think you're making some mistakes in what you say, but I think you're identifying some issues that I need to look at more closely with my advisor. I'm going to do that. I won't get back to you all the details because it's confidential, but I'll let you know roughly where we get. And thank you, Dan. If you'd done something like that, then not only would I have walked away, but I would have looked like an absolute idiot if I had pursued him aggressively. So it was his denials that made me certain in my mind, and the way that he was behaving that made me certain that he had something to hide. And of course he did, because it turned out at the same time he was sending me those letters, he was engaged in discussions with HMRC to settle the tax liability that he was denying to me that he had.
And Anna Isaac from The Guardian, I mean, journalists revealing how a story is put together, so sort of showing the to-ing and fro-ing behind the scenes, is something of a trend these days. You know, clearly we've seen, you know, Dan Needle, not a journalist, but putting a lot of this out there on social media, on platforms, and working with journalists as well. But, you know, 20 years ago, this was the thing that journalists kept quiet about to some extent, and now it feels like we reveal our workings much more.
I think it's important because it can show a consideration of fairness. It can show, well, here are all the factors I considered when I was working for you, the reader, the viewer, to arrive at these points. I think some of the constraints are always a little bit more sometimes, in some instances where you have to, for instance, in general terms, be very protective of your sourcing. So you have to be really considered about how you engage with some of, for instance, a legal letter, but just in general with how you show your workings. Source protection has to be paramount. You also have to consider how are you engaging when you publish correspondence. Now, for instance, The Independent made a decision, I'm obviously not there anymore, they made a decision to publish some of the emails that were received by journalists while I was there, between journalists and Mr. Zahawi. That's a bit different from the legal correspondence that Dan's referring to, but that's something that listeners might find interesting to take a look at. But it has to be so carefully considered. I think showing your working is about showing the reader why they can trust in your processes.
And is it quite unusual for a broadsheet to do that?
I think it has been known, for instance, where there's been a court case. There's been a lot of reporting of, you know, media court cases, and that often allows material to go into the public domain. And court reporting is a really important part of what media's done for a very long time. I think that the specific issue of legal correspondence, it's a case by case, and you really have to consider all of the factors at play there when you can make that decision.
And I suppose, you know, Dan has spent, presumably, Dan, you've actually spent quite a long time being a source, many years being a source before you became more front and centre in these sorts of stories. Is that right? To you,
no,
that question...
No, not a source per se. Right. For many years, I would act as a sounding board for journalists who ran into tax points.
Because this stuff is complicated.
This stuff is complicated, and finding experts is hard, and I was happy to help them. Naturally, never when I had a client involved, or my firm had a client involved, or an interest involved. But I was very happy to help them. And that actually helped me with this, because it meant that I knew a lot of the journalists already.
And Dan spent an awful lot of time on this. You presumably have too, but you've got a day job as well to do, and those sort of pressures in a newsroom around, you know, getting a daily story going and getting something over the line. It's harder to get these kind of stories over the line. You know, journalists are under pressure to deliver stories much more regularly than a story about Nadeem Zahawi. But these are the ones we remember, of course.
Yeah, no, that line between, you know, the big investigations and the daily reporting that helps you think about what is worth investigating is really hard to draw. I mean, I started my work looking at the cabinets, because this isn't the only tax story I've written about a member of the cabinet. I started really closely examining the tax affairs and the finances of cabinet members early last year. So it's been maybe a bit less on social media, but I've certainly been plugging away at it for a very long time, and The Guardian, and both The Independent and The Guardian, have been very generous with allowing me time to take a look at these things.
Well, if you get those kind of stories, they'll keep letting you do it. That's the way it goes, which is great. And Dan, do you see yourself as an activist now? I mean, how do you see your role going forward?
I'm not an activist. Most of what I do is writing about tax policy, problems in current tax policy, how it could be improved. Most of what I've written is about that. I've got a couple of stories which actually should have come out now, but have to be delayed because otherwise they bash into Zahawi and can confuse everyone, which are nothing to do with day-to-day politics. One of them involves tax avoidance in a well-known industry on a scale which makes Zahawi look like chicken feed. Another involves, let's call it an administrative practice, which has caused harm and perhaps suffering to hundreds of thousands of people. So these are the kind of things I really want to write about. I'm a tax nerd. I don't have a desire to be some tax witch finder general.
Both sound interesting, and do please come back on the media show if you get any of those over the line, because they sound fascinating as well. We like to delve into the processes behind getting these stories out there. So thank you both for coming on the programme, Anna Isaac and Dan Needle. That's absolutely brilliant.